Hello, welcome to High and Low, a Kershaw podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is a distraught man whose rice paddies were just violently destroyed.
Man, you're skipping ahead. I was about to talk about how, you know, there's many injustices in the world, and as a citizen, it's our duty to stand up. Also, there's, you know, Spencer, this is the time. I've decided this is the time to tell you that I'm madly in love with you, and I want to be your wife, and I won't tell anyone your secrets. I promise. I'll just be the good, doting. Yes, doting. That's the word I'm looking for. Doting wife. And if we get taken in by the secret police, they can do terrible things to me, but I will never reveal your secrets.
What if the police commissioner is your father?
No! Yeah, he's a right jerk in this movie.
Yeah.
Smoking that cigarette.
Yeah, he was kind of like a bad guy. He was weird.
Yeah, his younger version of himself without that mustache is just... He could play a gangster, no problem.
I'm sure he did.
Yep. Gotta find out.
Yeah, so the movie this... episode is No Regrets for Our Youth, which is
first. You mean No Regrets for My Youth?
Yes, for your youth.
Wait. You mean No Regrets in My Life?
Uh-huh.
Wait, you mean Waga Saishunai Kayunatsi Nashi?
Yes, that's what I mean.
Okay.
It's the first half of 1946 pairing. Next episode will be revealed later on episode, or listen to the previous episode, and you can know what it is. But, this was Kurosawa's first movie after the Imperial Japan fell, and MacArthur took over Japan, and it was kind of like a benevolent dictator, more or less.
Hey, that's the only details we get from this, because I was wondering what's up. Because we were talking about during The Most Beautiful, you were saying that he feels like that was his most personal film.
Yes.
But this, I mean, how much coercion went into the making of this film? Because this is like the counterpart of that film.
I'm not sure, but it's definitely like the anti-propaganda movie.
Yeah, and I feel like it's also where The Most Beautiful felt kind of standard, you know, with some nice Kurosawa touches in it. I feel like Kurosawa was allowed to do a bunch of different things that like were inspired by other directors at the time. Mm-hmm. And like, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that this movie inspired other directors itself, because there were some parts in this movie that I found just like absolutely breathtaking. Like
it's very neo-realist.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that until I read the DVD slip of the post-war Kurosawa set that I have.
I see.
And the essay in it. But, never, that's not relevant. Anyway, so, yeah. I remember I first saw this a while ago, and I made a mistake of watching it when I was tired. So I fell asleep through it the first time I watched it. And so I barely remembered anything.
That's understandable. I'd say the first 30 minutes of this movie kind of feels like a generic fare. And it's very similar, once again, to Army in this case, because it's, you know, it keeps flashing forward in time, and we're seeing... the funny thing is we're not really seeing these people grow up. They're obviously grown-ass people dressed as students in the beginning, but... Mm-hmm. But we, you know, we progress through time. It skips forward 5 years here, 5 years there, stuff like that. And then once it like sticks to the beginnings of the war, you know, that's when the movie starts to get real juicy and interesting.
Yeah. But Okay, so the cinematography in this was done by Asakuzo Nakai, who was his cinematographer for pretty much also his entire career. Like, this guy, he shot all the big famous ones. He did Dersu Uzala. Like, he did kind of, like, he followed Kurosawa throughout his whole career.
Cool. I mean, the guy's a genius, so.
He did Ran. Nope, Ran was the last one he did with Kurosawa.
Mm.
But, yeah, that's kind of a really long run of great work. But, who else? And I'm not sure if you noticed, but, Susumu Fujita was in it as the husband, well, future husband. He is, he was Sanshiro Sugata.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about Noge in the movie.
Yeah, and, the guy from Men Who Tread on Tiger's Tales, the main one who was like the big guy who did like the Buddhist poem thing.
Yeah, the main character.
Yeah, played the professor, father, and pretty much like a lot of the cast. There's some other cast members in it, but I recognize almost all of them. And the father of Noge, he was the one of Goofy Old Men in Scandal, and he played like an old man and like everything.
He's been an old man forever.
I
didn't recognize him later in the movie, but when they showed that photograph of Noge's parents, I was like, oh yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah, he just would play an old man, either goofy or serious, and kind of everything.
Yep. Hopefully that'll be my role someday.
Yeah.
What about Itokawa? I don't know if I recognized him at all. Looks like he was also in The Men Who Tread on Tiger's Tail.
Yeah, he wasn't very memorable to me.
No, the funny, like, I mean...
I think maybe that was the point, that he's not that memorable.
Yeah. You know, he got the regular job, he got the regular life, he grew the regular mustache. What is the... Yeah.
Okay, he's in Sanshiro Sugata, if I don't remember where. He's in Sanshiro the Bailiff. Yeah, I don't remember him in the other movies that I've seen with him.
He's in both Sanshiro Sugata, so... One of the ongoing characters. I have no idea which one, though.
Yeah, there are some that weren't even named, so I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So, who else? And the mother of Noge, she was in a bunch of Ozu stuff.
He came in and swept him up.
Uh-huh. The Fujita character, Noge, feels like if Kurosawa had Toshiro by this point, it would have been Toshiro.
Yeah, definitely.
Which further proves my thesis that Toshiro kind of stole his spot from Kurosawa.
Yeah, maybe Kurosawa had a falling out with him, just like he had with the
Toshiro later on.
Yep, Susumu.
I mean, Susumu was still in stuff up until High and Low.
Right.
I think he was in Redbeard, but a lot of people were in Redbeard. We'll get to that one in a month or so with a special guest, hopefully. But, this movie is kind of weird because on one hand, I like certain parts of it a lot, but it, for me, doesn't mesh together very organically.
Well, that's, I mean, I can definitely see that with the beginning part. Like I was saying, I feel like there is, it's the beginning feels like it's focusing more on actual events and trying to push characters into the historical context. And once, like I said, once they start hit the ground and actually start developing a story for the characters, then it feels like a more interesting movie. But I mean, where are you feeling the real separation?
The first act of like 1933 with like the invasion of China stuff and the student revolts felt like that going into the script just felt kind of like that. I mean, clear, like it just felt kind of choppy a little to me. Like you could still tell Kurosawa was trying to develop like his social commentary.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Like I mean, it would be interesting to know what he actually thought about those situations, because obviously before the end of the war, he wouldn't have been able to make a movie that was criticizing any actions by the Japanese. And that's what this movie does straight from the beginning.
Yeah, like, I'm amazed he got it made to begin with. But then again, the Americans were in charge, and MacArthur kind of was a benevolent dictator, if you kind of look into how he ran things, which was kind of shitty, but also he wasn't that bad at the same time.
Yeah, and it might have been a situation where this is another Toho, right?
Toho.
Where they wanted to please the Americans that were now in charge of everything, including the film industry. It's like, oh, we'll make this one. It's, you know, it has historical context, so it'll be interesting to the Japanese audience, but it's also showing that, hey, we're aware that some crazy stuff happened.
Yeah, maybe. That might be it. But, this is the only Kurosawa movie with a female lead.
Yeah, I saw that. And he picked the A number one he could have. I mean,
yeah, there's...
How many things had she been in before this? It looks like actually quite a lot.
She started in the late 30s, and she was in like 50 movies before she worked with Ozu for the first time.
Yeah.
So she was already established.
Well established, yeah. That's interesting.
It's just kind of weird. She's thought of as like, oh, like Ozu, like famous for being with Ozu, but it's like she was already really famous to begin with.
Yeah, because it seems like in America at least she wasn't famous for her massive filmography. I bet there's tons of Japanese actors that have just as much as a heavy filmography as she does. But having worked with Ozu, who was not considered a master until after, you know, his film career had ended, and her being in so many of his masterpieces, like, of course, now it's going to be like, oh, she's Ozu's, you know, siren and stuff like that.
You know, she gets only in 6 Ozu movies.
Only in 6, but Tokyo Story, late spring. Yeah, some big titles.
Yeah, and, as you know, Paul Schrader was the one who introduced Ozu to Hollywood.
Paul Schrader, the writer of Taxi Driver?
And Cruising, yes, him.
Paul Schrader, the writer of Here's to the Young Ladies? No, wait, that's... That's a Setsuko Haro movie. Never
mind. Yeah.
Yeah, she is amazing in this movie. And I don't mean, like, I should have expected it, but I'd never seen her do something like she does in this movie. And it feels brave to me. Like, when an American actress does what she does in this movie, which is to go from looking like a star to getting, like, no makeup, like, physically exerting herself, you know, looking like she's covered in sweat.
Mm-hmm.
That's considered a brave thing for, you know, beautiful Hollywood actresses to do. So I feel like it's, like, 20-fold here in this 1946 movie. Or,
Yeah, 46.
Yeah, 46. So if she wasn't, you know, a known commodity in Japan, I don't know how Americans would have felt about it at the time. But I have no idea when the U.S. even saw this movie. Do you know?
I was looking at New York Times reviews for us, and I couldn't find any one review of it. But like, it was shown in the U.S. for the first, the earliest time I could find was the late 70s when it was first shown in America.
Mm.
Like, and there's some, I forgot what it was called, this New York Times article about this, 12 movies about post-war Japan, and this was picked for one of them. They for a different theme. I forgot what they might have picked this one exactly.
I see.
Maybe like the recovery effort or something, but like Pigs and Battleships was another movie they picked.
Jeez.
And there was
that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, when it comes to foreign movies, I think that people might think that Japanese or French or Italian mm-hmm. or any of those are superior to American films because there's so much mm-hmm. crap that comes out of the U.S. and we, you know, it just goes straight to the theater or whatever. And Japan, every time somebody comes over, like especially back then, you know, it's a cream of the crop stuff. It's like, obviously the Japanese are superior filmmakers. It's like, no, they make just as much shit. It just doesn't come over. Yeah. It's like now we have more access to foreign titles directly off of when they come out and stuff like that. It's like if you really want to be aware of the difference between U.S. movies and Japan, it's probably just because we make more movies than them. But it's probably the same amount of crap per good stuff capita, you know, whatever that number is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and another movie that I was trying to think of was the Ozu film, Record of a Tenement Gentleman, another one, which is, we were like, why pick that Ozu movie?
Well, that's a good one.
It's good, but
it's not his best, but it is a very... Yeah,
there are better post-war Ozus to pick.
I mean, but if you're gonna, if you're gonna see a triple feature of those three movies, you've got a pretty yeah. good life going for you.
Yeah, and 9 other Japanese movies about post-war society.
Oh, sure.
Which I kind of wish I could have been there in 79.
You weren't even a twinkle in your father's eye.
Neither were you.
I was a twinkle. It'd be 2 years, but I was a twinkle.
All right.
According to this thing on IMDb, it says June 6, 1980 release in the U.S.
Oh, the New York Times review is... Not review, but the thing about the 12 movie thing is April 22nd, 1979.
Mm. Maybe it just means it got like a, that was like a film festival premiere thing or whatever.
Maybe. So yeah, it, like a lot early, Kurosawa, No Regrets, took a little while to actually reach the U.S.
Yeah.
I think Rashomon was the first one that was like, immediately came to the U.S.
Right.
Heavy Rashomon.
Well, here's another thing that I think is going on with that. Like, once all these Kurosawa movies start coming over, once again, we're getting, once again, the cream of the crop there. Like, mm-hmm. I think if you watch, you know, Yojimbo, you watch Seven Samurai, you watch... Son earlier, you know, that's also a masterpiece. Yeah. And then you watch No Regrets for My Youth.
Mm-hmm.
You might think, oh, No Regrets for My Youth is pretty good, but it's not as good as these other ones. I kind of think this is a masterpiece.
Hmm.
Like, I mean, we've already talked about how the first half feels kind of weird and haphazard.
Yeah.
But once I keep thinking about that shot where Setsuko Hara is, what's his, Noge is leaving the house, you know, after uh-huh. having visited after many years, and he's going to move away to Tokyo. We're not going to see him a long time. And you see her with her back against the door, and the shot is the montage of her changing positions. You know, you don't physically see her changing positions. It's just like, she morphs into herself, like going through the struggle of like, what should I do? What should I do? And I like that's like master. That's a masterwork as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I can't think of any other time I've seen something quite like that.
I feel like I have, but I feel like I've seen it in like silent movies, you know, back.
Oh yeah, that did feel like a silent type of shot.
Exactly.
Because it was this,
mm-hmm.
It was this like move, it was like literally like still images basically.
Right, and movements to relay emotion because we didn't have words. So that kind of the thing makes sense, but and there's another, now I'm blanking. There's another shot that I was like absolutely blown away from. That's another Setsuko Hara thing in this movie, and maybe I'll remember it when we're actually talking about the movie. Yeah. But yeah, there's just some so like supremely masterful, and I guarantee that if I looked back at the last, you know, 30 years of movies, I'd see what kind of stuff Kurosawa was actually referencing when he did that, but it doesn't mm-hmm. matter.
Well, yeah, I'm getting, it's probably some silent movie.
Right. Yeah, like they say, everything is a remix. Like, you can go back forever, and you're going to see examples of stuff that you thought was original or is more famous than the original version of it.
Oh, yeah. But, I love... Well, it goes without saying, but the cinematography is great, and you get this, the Kurosawa thing of, it's a low angle of people walking,
yep.
Which is just always works, and I like that this time, another big example I can think of is Yojimbo, and with Yojimbo, it's from the opposite angle, showing like how badass Sanjuro is.
Yeah.
But in this one, it's like this neo-realist from behind, like a like slice of everyday life feeling.
Yeah.
I think it's her and Ito walking like down a road.
Is that Noge's mother?
Itokawa, I think it
oh,
was.
Oh, okay. So they were the walking. Lawyer guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Mustache Man.
Yes. Oh yeah, and the use of clothes in this was very clever. Where not well, it's pretty glaring if you're paying attention. Mm-hmm. Where like in the beginning, she's dressed very Western, very like. Like a spoiled rich girl, which basically what she is in the beginning.
Sure.
And then she's, I wouldn't say like tomboyish, but not like traditionally Japanese, feminine in a Japanese way. And then in the second act, suddenly you see her wearing like traditional Japanese clothes, and she's trying to fit into society because militarism is coming into play. And then she's like sheds like the Western fashion and like the traditional fashion and just like becomes her own person when she's a farmer.
There's a lot of this movie that is Western until the end. Like, did you notice that there's not a scene where people use any sort of chopstick? They're always using knife and fork.
I never noticed that.
It kind of weirded me out. Like, in the very beginning, you see... Or not in the very beginning, but at a later part when she's having a meal with her family, they're sitting around the table, and they're eating with knives and forks. And I was like, that's weird. You know, because they do come off... You know, the professor walks around in his robes once he gets ousted from the university and stuff like that. Yeah. And her mother seems kind of a traditional Japanese, you know, mother role. But they play piano.
Not the only movie where her playing piano was relevant to the plot.
She must have really played piano, huh?
Yeah, or maybe she's good at. Well, this movie she's not good at faking it. There's some shots that are not good.
Yeah, but the hand movements are okay.
Yeah, the hand movements are good, but you don't see the keys move.
No, that's ridiculous. You don't need to see keys move.
Okay.
Feel the music in your heart.
Yeah, sure. Anything else you want to bring up before we get through the plot part?
No, we've already been talking for 30 minutes.
Okay. All right, so...
So what year does this open?
It opened in 1933 at the Kyoto University.
1933, we see a huge group of students that are all marching together, and they're all singing. And they walk by this couple that are hanging out in the field, and they identify this person as a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep on going, but there's a couple of people that stand out. It's all male students except for one lady who says, yeah. You know, yells for her father. Her father is the professor, and that's Itsuko Hara's character. Whose name is... Oh, wrong screen. Yuki!
Yeah, Yuki.
Yuki.
Yugihara.
Yugi-oh! No, Yuki. And she... He's got two guys that are mostly hanging around. Like, they're ahead of the group. There's a part where they're going to cross over a river, and the two guys hop from rock to rock ahead of them. And she gets to a point where she's going to have to make a big leap in order to get across. One of these boys is Itokawa. I'd say he's a more traditionally handsome-looking guy. He's just getting, you know, normal face.
Yeah,
and the other kid is Noge, and he's got a big pair of glasses. He looks a little bit bulkier, you know. He looks like he does a little judo. No, not really. But
I don't know. You think he lost all that judo muscle by this point?
I'm not sure. He looks okay later. Here he looks a little. I don't know. I think they boyed him up to make him a little bit boyish, even though he's probably in his 30s or whatever.
Oh yeah, he was a year or two younger than Kurosawa.
Yeah,
who was in his 30s at this point.
Yeah, there you go. And they both of these boys hold out their hands for Yuki, who does not go until Noge decides, "Ah, screw it," walks across the little bit of water there and just picks her up. You know, I don't know if there's a word for that. He cradles her in his arms there and takes her across the land. And everybody's embarrassed except for the other students, who are all clapping for her. Or clapping for this act of, you know, chivalry, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's just a little bit about these characters. It's a pretty good starting point. You can see they both have interest in Yuki, and Noge is the one who will take a risk.
Yeah, he's a bad boy.
And the funny thing about this is we kind of establish later... That I think, like, right after this part, we get to the, you know, the burning of Manchuria or whatever, the invasion of China, and then the student revolts. They oust this professor because he has liberal leanings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the students all try to revolt in response, and they try to get the other professors to say they're going to quit their jobs. And they do quit their jobs, but then the I don't know, whoever's in charge of them begs them to come back, and they do. So it's this big to-do that's really not... In the movie, it's represented just by a bunch of, like, text on screen, newspaper-type stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. It's a very Hollywood, like, newspapers headlines to tell... get across exposition.
Yeah. I'm sure it's based on reality. I don't know about the student revolutions.
The Kyoto student revolts were real. It's based off of the response to the invasion of China.
I see.
Where a lot of college kids were protesting, but it didn't go so well for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, back then, you can't talk bad about Japan, otherwise you're going to get trouble.
Yeah, you know, the emperor is, you know, a god on earth.
It's kind of like our country now. You can't talk bad about the U.S. or you're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, he'll just cry on Twitter about it.
Everyone will cry on Twitter.
Yeah.
When I'm done... No. later we see a scene where they're having meetings at the professor's house, and they're talking about, you know, the kind of actions they have to take and whether they're willing to leave school for their beliefs and you know, the wrongs that the Japanese are doing. And Setsuko's character says, like, "I hate those Reds." And they're like, "What are you talking about? Your father got fired for this very reason." He's like, "My father's not a commie or red or whatever. He's just left-leaning, you know?" And Noge basically gets in her face and is like, "You are so childish. You don't know what the hell you're talking about." And he takes off. And that just sets Yuki off. She can't, you know, this is her most spoiled, childish, you know, acting type thing where she's like, like, "Ah, man, the country's rhetoric against the left-leaning has gotten to her, at least, because she wants to, you know, why would they tell her otherwise?"
Yeah.
And Itokawa is kind of, you know, he also believes the same thing that Noge does, but he's not the confrontational type. He wouldn't call Yuki a child or anything like that. He's just, you know.
She's kind of like an out-of-touch rich person.
Exactly. Basically. Right.
Like, and there, she doesn't mean any harm. She is, you know, not fully aware of the situation affecting the people who aren't her class.
Yeah. And at this point, this is a point where Noge basically disappears for the movie for a while.
Yeah.
A lot of people talking about Noge. Noge not showing up. But they're having a student meeting at the professor's house. The professor is a part of these meetings. But he's trying to... I believe he is trying to convince these young students not to quit school. Because even though he understands they're upset and they want to show the... you know, they're rebelling against it by doing this, he still thinks that their future is more important than the, you know, chances of ruining everything because of their political beliefs. And we see Yuke is, you know, she's listening in on these conversations. She's not really a part of them. Itokawa is not there. It turns out that he is still at his house, where his mother is begging him not to leave school. And he was determined he was going to, but his mother is saying, like, "You're going to ruin your life. I know that this is what you believe." It's kind of funny the way she says it. "I know the way this is what you believe, but I don't think you're thinking about how I feel about it." Yeah. So, as the other students are packing up to leave, they're talking about Itokawa, and they're like, "Oh, he's a traitor." Like, "No, we don't know that. You guys are just saying things. You're saying crazy stuff. I mean, we don't know why he didn't show up." But there's obviously some students that are ready to start shit more than others. You know, hot-headed.
Yeah. I need to clarify something. This is 1933 still.
Oh, okay.
1938.
And after, you know, they all leave, Yuki sees them off. And then Itokawa, she asks about Noge. Where is Noge? And the students vaguely talk about, like, "Oh, he's deep in this. He's underground, you know."
Yeah, he's gone too far.
He's rogue. He's gone full nut bar. No.
He's a rogue nation.
Yep. He's a ghost protocol.
He's directed by John Woo, your favorite director.
My favorite director, John Woo.
Yeah, you love all his movies.
Yeah. Payback. I remember watching The Killer. Anyways, back to this movie. After those students leave, Itokawa does show up. And Yuki asks him why it took so long, you know, for him to get there. And he says, "Well, I don't think I can leave school. You know, it's very important to my mother that I stay there. So I don't think I'm going to be able to leave like Noge did or whatever." Like, "Oh, Noge already left school, huh?" I'm like, yep. I think at this point we flash forward again.
Wait.
Do you have notes? Because I don't have notes. I had notes, and I don't know where I put them.
No. But when all the other guys leave, and before Iokawa shows up, there's this shot of her on the stairs, like frustrated that Itakawa wasn't there. And it's this very beautiful, another shot that looks like it's like from a silent movie type shot of her just sitting on the stairs, flustered.
Yeah.
And then he comes in, and she's upset with him.
He's not serious.
Yeah, he's a sellout.
She doesn't know if she wants serious. She doesn't know what she wants at this point.
Oh.
And he's obviously in there. We don't know what the situation is there, but you know, she's always asking about Noge, so obviously that's kind of her obsession.
Yeah. And she's 20 in 1933.
Mm-hmm. So
this is now after that's 1938.
38. I don't know what's going on here. Itakawa is over there, right?
Let's see. I put military march because the first thing you see is a big old military march, and Yuki is at a flower arrangement class, and she's dressed very traditional, and she clearly doesn't like doing this very traditional Japanese feminine thing.
But she's so good at it.
Yeah, and she starts tearing up her arrangement, and you see her throw these flowers into a pot of water, and it's this perfectly separated, like, flowers just spinning around.
Three flowers. Perfectly spinning around.
Yeah, representing her, Itakawa, and Noge.
Yep.
How they're always spinning, how they're in orbit with each other.
They're always spinning. They're crazy spinning.
And seeing that, I was like, oh, Kurosawa likes to use flowers in his movies. Because it made me think of Dreams and Sanjuro and Sanjuro Sugata, Seven Samurai, he has flowers in a key scene there. Yeah, flowers show up a lot. I didn't really realize until now.
I mean, I didn't know I was supposed to be taking notes on these things. Otherwise, I'd have a full list for you, you know.
Oh, yeah, well.
So at this moment, you know, it's obviously Yuki is feeling dissatisfied with this life that she's being put into, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the only thing her parents have shown, but I think knowing these revolutionaries that have been coming to the house has been slowly been creeping into her influence.
Yeah.
And so later they have, I think Itakawa comes over to the house, right?
Yes.
And at this point, is he a lawyer or is he still training to be a lawyer?
He's a prosecutor.
Prosecutor, okay. And so he finished school, he's already got a job.
And he's warning the professor about giving free legal advice.
That's right. The professor's like, why shouldn't I be doing this? It's like, I'm just telling you, in the position that you are in, and because of how you've left your work, you know, it's just going to look bad. Especially, like, at this point, they're getting into the war, right?
38, yeah, where they're starting to go across the Pacific at this point.
Yeah. Or no, there's an actual part where they declare that they are attacking against England and the U.S., right? That's in the 40s.
Yeah, but they also started going around the Pacific trying to conquer it before that, like the Philippines and all that. And they tried to reach Australia, but that kind of didn't quite happen for them. Does Noge come to the to dinner too?
Yeah, it says that Noge will be stopping by, and okay. Their reaction is like, oh, he's coming, or I think the professor says Noge's coming here, and Itakawa's like, oh, he's coming here, huh? And he does, he, you know, Noge shows up and he seems like, you know, we've been hearing these like stories of what a crazy revolutionary he is and all that stuff like that. But he's acting very casual, you know, he's enjoying his conversation and dinner with the family and stuff like that. But Yuki is not even making eye contact. She is just looking down or away.
Yeah, she's doing that thing that I've seen her do in multiple movies. But I believe he mentioned something about he went to prison, and now he had to revoke his leftist views to get paroled. And he quote unquote did, and no one seems to believe him.
Right. Yeah. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Of course I have. And this causes, you know, this news causes Yuki to run upstairs. You know, she can't believe that he would say this kind of stuff like that. She's got this idea in her head that Noge is a crazy person who will do whatever his heart wants him to do. And is it her father who follows her up there? Because Noge's going to leave. Oh, no, that's right. Her father doesn't follow her up there. But she hears, like, come down, you know, and say goodbye. Noge's going to be leaving. Oh, he's going to move to Tokyo, he says.
Yeah, that's where the montage of her, like, crumbling behind a door. Against
the door, yep.
Against the door, yeah.
And she runs back downstairs. It's too late. He's already left at that point.
And I think she's walking home with Itagawa. Yeah. And basically she says, if I marry you, like, my life will be stable but boring.
Yeah, she's kind of harsh.
Yeah.
Like,
he takes it pretty well.
I understand. If I were with you, you know, we'd have a nice normal life and things would go on normally, but there's an excitement, you know, if I was with Noge, you know, there's dangerous. I'm afraid of him, she says. And that's exciting, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's
like, that's pretty brutally honest. And yeah, he just laughs it off. He's like, yeah, well, you're right. Okay, yeah. Later.
I got the feeling he's probably used to hearing stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of a real basic bitch, but... He seems happy with his life choice.
You think
he wasn't happy with his life?
I don't. You know, I wouldn't call him the happiest, but he also doesn't seem to want anything crazy.
He seems content with the situation.
He's decided that this is how he's going to live.
Oh yeah. So she wants to move to Tokyo, and.
Right. Unexpectedly, yeah.
Yeah, kind of suddenly and unexpectedly, and you learn she went to college, or like, I guess like some sort of college, and she has training in foreign language and typing, so she can get a job and everything. And get a job, and so. I didn't write down what convinced her dad to let her go. But she said something that convinced him to let her go.
Well, he follows her into the room while she's packing, and he tells her, you know, it's going to be a hard life. You're going to have to live hard and work really hard, and nothing's going to come easy for you. And if you're okay with that, then I'm okay with that. It's basically...
Okay.
And she's, at this point, she's like determined to go to change her life. She doesn't want this happy, she doesn't want this like easy living that she's been doing this whole time.
Yeah.
And so we flash forward again.
1941. Not the movie by
Steven Spielberg.
Steven Spielberg with Christopher Lee and Toshiro Mifune. It's the year 1941. And, she's in Tokyo. She's had an established job and a whole established life. and she kind of randomly runs into Itokawa, I think at a train station or something, and they decide to have a dinner and catch up, and it's...
it's like, would you like to have dinner? Oh, don't, you know, at first she's kind of like looking down like, no, and he's like, oh, don't worry, I'm married.
Yeah, which was really, oh, that's weird. And he says, I'm married, and I'm going to be a dad soon, too.
Yep.
And so it's like, oh, well.
I guess that's safe, then.
Yeah.
But I forgot there was a part where they were talking about Noge wanting to get not only move to Tokyo, but he also wanted to move to China.
Oh, yeah.
And that she was also talking about that, like this was a possibility for her.
Yeah, she wants to go to China, but...
So, I don't think...
Did she say why she wanted to go to China?
No, she's just following directly in his footsteps.
Yeah. Okay.
And, yeah, so while they go out and have, you know, whatever drinks or food or whatever. This is another knife and fork moment, but they're in the big city. So.
Yep, okay. And very pointedly, and the screen, the shot is a very, for Kurosawa, a very weirdly Ozu-like shot of just the table, center frame, and then on opposite sides. Him on the right and she's on the left. Get it?
Yes, yes, I do.
Yeah, she's on the left. Get it?
No.
Okay.
He should have been in the middle of the table.
Well, yeah, he is real basic. He could have been in the middle, but... Yeah.
He tells her, like, oh, I bet you didn't even know Noge's, you know, in the city. He, like, works nearby and everything like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and I think he has some business... they does within China or something.
Mm-hmm.
He does something with China. I forgot what exactly.
Yeah. And so we see a scene where mm-hmm. Noge is working at some sort of a facility with people.
Can you pause for a second? Not pause, no. But...
No, let the dog on the microphone.
Oh, you can hear her?
Yes.
All right, yeah, give me a little bit. I got to do something.
So, yes, Noge is working at this factory or whatever, and a younger person comes in and says, hey, Noge, there's somebody here to see you. He's like, I'm not expecting anyone. It's like, oh, it's a young lady. This kid's a dork.
Yeah.
And so he's like, okay. So he walks out to looks in this office. That she's not. Nobody's there. He looks around. Nobody's there. He opens the front doors to their to the waiting area. Nobody's there. And he's like, hey, I thought you said somebody was waiting for me. And then we see Yuki running down the stairs. She's chickened out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is
what. Mm-hmm.
This is the other thing I was thinking of when I was talking about how cool the shot was.
Mm-hmm.
And this montage of her over and over again, you know, walking by the building, kind of hanging out near it, looking in, just like the progression, showing the progression of time where she did not go in, even though she knew Noge was in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
It was... Yeah. And Noge actually, he catches her snooping around.
That's what happened.
Yeah. He notices her, like, peeking through the window. And then he's like, hey, what are you doing here? And she gets all embarrassed.
Yep. And he's like, I can't remember what happens at this point.
Yeah.
And this is—I mean—they end up together, is what happens.
Yeah, they right? get married, and he is still a leftist.
Right. She says, "I know there's things that you're doing that you're not telling me about," and he's like, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "And it's okay. Like you don't have to tell me anything. I love you, and I trust you, no matter what you're doing. You know. And so this is mm-hmm. a big deal."
Yeah.
And there's the fun in this movie. There are several times where he's like obviously embracing her and possibly, mm-hmm. you know, kissing her. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there was a, like, a decency standard or something like that, because there is no showing of any kissing whatsoever in this movie.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I do think it was probably a censorship thing.
Yeah. It's not necessary for the movie. I just thought I did think it was kind of strange. But he does a lot of, like, I'm so happy that we're together, you know, every moment we spend together. And one of the things that he says over and over again is, I have no regrets for my life. That's the way I live my life. Everything I've done, I do not regret. And everything I will do, I will not regret.
Yeah, it's as if that's titular to the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. And he, and later, after they've been married for a while, they've been together for a while, he comes home one night and he says, we just finished a huge project and I want to celebrate. You know, you're not going to see any results from this right now. And at this point, it's like we're in the war. It's, you know, yeah, the Japanese have joined the Axis powers or whatever they're called.
It's 1941, Pearl Harbor, all that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to see results for this for at least 10 years, but I promise you what we've started today is going to be major, and the Japanese people will be happy. And so he has to leave the house for some reason. Like, they're going to celebrate. And if you're like me, or like any savvy movie watcher, you're like, no, don't celebrate. Now don't leave the house. You're going to get caught. I know the way this works. And he does. He goes and stops at some place. I don't know if he was meeting somebody or he was stopping for a drink or something like that. Or maybe it was a setup in the first place. But
I thought it was a setup in the
Yeah. He's got a package with him, and he realizes that there's a police officer looking at him. So he tries to get up and run, and he gets tackled by a couple of other guys. And then my father shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. I closed that page. What was the name of the actor?
Takashi Shimura.
Takashi Shimura. Looking smug as all hell. Like, I caught this mother effer, and this package he has is probably full of secrets and sabotage stuff. And, oh, no, it's a lady's purse. That's weird.
Yeah.
And so later, there's knocking at the house door, and she's like, oh, you're back. Wonderful. Let's celebrate. And as soon as she opens the door, a bunch of goofballs rush in and like, we've arrested Noge. And, you know, it's obvious that you had something to do with his life. So you're under arrest too. And they take her to an interrogation room. They're like, they ask him over and over again, how do you know Noge? What does Noge do for a living? What kind of blah, blah, blah activities can you tell us about? And she keeps quiet. She doesn't say a single word to these three cops.
Mm-hmm. And your father is smoking a cigarette, trying to get answers.
Did you see his character name?
Yes, I did.
That's, what the hell?
That must be what the translation of the name must be.
I want to know if that's like a based on a real person or something.
I know the Fujita character is Noge is based off a real person.
Oh yeah,
who was a Soviet spy.
Oh
yeah,
that's interesting. So that's interesting because I've seen movies like that more recently where it's like a person interacting with an actual historical figure that may or may not have existed, like following them through their life.
Yeah, but like the...
But was Poison Strawberry a real person?
That seems like a very specific reference to something, probably, at the that was like relevant to like Japan at the time.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was like an in-joke with a cast with the cast members or something.
Yeah,
who knows?
She gets placed in prison with just regular old prison. You know, we see mm-hmm. her in a cell. Shots of a man walking in between the cells, just doing his walk. And at the very end, there she is, sitting against the wall. And time moves forward. They're still interrogating her. She's still not saying anything, but she's starting to look horrible. You know, she hasn't been able to change her clothes or anything. Like, they're holding her.
Oh, before he left to celebrate,
yep.
He shows a picture of his parents to her.
That's right. He says that this is the biggest, or because she hugs him, and she gets poked by something. And it turns out he's carrying a framed picture of his parents all the time.
Yeah,
which I think is kind of funny. And he says this is the biggest. What is it? He says something specific. It's like the.
I did not write that down.
The most vulnerable part of me, or something like that.
Sounds
and
like
he says he hadn't seen his parents in a decade. And yeah. He thinks about them all the time. But yes, while she's in prison, eventually she does get released because it's apparent that she doesn't know anything or she's not going to talk. And it's also because, is it Itokawa? Is that what that character's name is?
Uh-huh.
He finally shows up to save the day or something like that.
Yeah.
And, Itokawa, yeah, gets her back. She goes back home. And the professor is getting ready to go out to defend Noge, you know, while he's still imprisoned because he, you know, he owes it to the boy or whatever. And Itokawa breaks the news to everybody that Noge died in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Just suddenly the character is not there anymore. It's like, it's harsh. It's sad. The movie does an excellent job.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like melodramatic for sake of being melodramatic. It really works and feels real. Like, it adds to like the neorealism of it.
Yeah. And to get personal, you and I both have dealt with death recently, like with association, and the feeling that it's like when one day a person's there and suddenly they're not. It's like that is exactly what it's like, and it's just yeah. Like, yeah.
And where I work, it's like that too, at a nursing yeah. home. So you yeah. never get used to it.
No. And she's of course Yuki is devastated by this. And at first, her parents want her to stay there and come back to her old life. You know, they've still got money, whatever. They're still upper middle class or whatever the equivalent is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't be that rich. I mean, the professor's a leftist. Come on.
Yeah.
Or maybe the rich are only leftists. No, I don't know. But she decides that she has to go and see his parents. And her parents are like, no, why, you know, you don't have to do that. There's absolutely no reason to. It's just like, I have to. Like, it's like, I feel it in my heart. So she does. She leaves to go to the very small village where Noge lived. And it's a total rural village. It's completely different than any other place we've seen here. You know, they're still living in the kind of old Japanese style buildings with the sliding, you know, doors, the gate out front, but you know, they don't have like locks, they don't have physical doorknobs. You know, it's like as rural as you could get.
Yeah, it's very traditional.
And she sees that the entire house is boarded up. And actually, the very first scene that we see with Yuke and Noge's parents is his mother is digging a grave by herself. She's just digging and digging, like, you know, mm-hmm. the full 6 feet practically. And they didn't even go to claim Noge's body, is what they're told, because they were so ashamed of him, because obviously the government is telling everyone he was a spy. We don't even know what his actions are. Yeah, I don't think that actually gets told in the movie.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't really matter, ultimately.
Right, it doesn't. And Yuki's there watching. She, you know, hands over the ashes that they've received. And they start to bury it again. And her mother's telling her, there's no reason for you to stay here. Like, we are night people. We can't even go out during the day because we're so ashamed, and the village treats us terribly. You know, there's graffiti outside the house that says spies or a spy lived here or, you know, whatever. And they're living like these mole people. You know, his father, Noge's father, is so destitute that he doesn't react anymore. You know, he sleeps, he eats, and he sits by, you know, in the middle of the house all day.
Yeah.
So Noge's mother is the only one who's keeping this running. And Yuki says, I want to see what you do. I want to know what you do every day. And in the middle of the night, she gets up, Noge's mother, and Yuki goes along with him. And they begin tearing into the field with their... I don't know what that is. It's not a hoe, but...
I'm not sure. But they're digging up a rice paddy so it can grow rice and have a farm.
Right, and Yuki's never done a day of hard labor in her life. Like, she follows her out to this field to start working, and she's dressed, you know, in her nice shirt and her nice pants. But as soon as she realizes what needs to be done, she grabs the tool of her own, and she starts smacking away, you know, tearing at pieces of earth.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you know, this once again, montage, great montage of her sweating and rolling up her sleeves and looking at her hands that are covered with blisters now.
Yeah, and those hands used to be used for playing piano.
Exactly. And she, like, for a while this goes on where she's helping out every night and doing this. But one day she gets up and she just leaves the house with her tool to go work in the field. She doesn't care that people or, you know, the Noge's mom is making fun of her, or not making fun of her, is telling her that, you know, people are going to treat you like terribly. Don't go out there. You know? And so she gets her tool. She starts walking out. And this was so effective. Like, everyone in the mm-hmm. village is the gossipy little bitches.
Yeah.
They can't help themselves. They see her walking. They know who she is. This is Noge's ex, you know, his wife, you know. That's the wife of a spy. There's children that are chanting something about, you know, a spy, or whatever. And the feeling of anxiety I got from this was, yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah, it was, it felt in some ways almost dreamlike.
Yeah. Nightmare. Like one of those stress nightmares that you have.
Oh, yeah.
Like you're at work and so everything's going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But she goes to the field and she starts pulling out whatever they're doing to get the rice paddies ready, you know. Getting the field ready and packing it into her pack and moving and just doing everything by herself. And everybody's just watching her do this. You know, back then I was thinking they didn't really have TVs in these rural villages. This is as much entertainment as they're going to get.
Yeah. They're going to see this, you know, this rich city woman try to farm.
Yeah. Who the hell does she think she is? This is like the circus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She's like digging stuff. That's crazy.
And she inspires her mother-in-law to join in and leave the house during the day.
Yep. Just when she thinks you think that she's going to fall over, because she does fall and she can't. She keeps trying to push herself up, and every time she crumbles down again, there's the sound of laughter. Like you don't know if it's in her head or if people are actually laughing at her. Like, it could be either way, because people are disgusting.
Yeah.
As a general statement, people suck.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah. But, yes, eventually, Noge's mother does come out and lift her up, takes the pack off her back, and they begin working in the field together and start doing things during the day. Yuke takes the boards off the front of the house. You know, she's tired of hiding. And they go, after plowing the field, they take the individual rice plants and they put them all into the newly, you know, I don't know what the term is there. The rice paddies are full of water.
Yeah.
And they plant each individual field. And there's tons of fields. It's like a huge amount of work. And I don't know if it's supposed to be one day of work. That would be crazy. But
oh, I no. think, rice is a very intensive crop to maintain.
It's just these two women that are doing it by themselves. And they prepare a huge amount of rice. And Nogi's mother is so happy. She can't believe they did it. You know, this momentary moment of joy, you know, yeah, this moment of joy that they haven't had since their son went away, you know, since their son was declared a spy. And the very next day, after sleeping, Yuki wakes up to the sound of somebody sobbing. And it is Noge's mother. Somebody has gone into the rice paddy that they broke their backs over.
Oh, but when she wakes up, it's a shot of, it's like almost like an Ozu shot from the floor of just her face, and in the background you see the mother-in-law crying, walking by.
Yeah. Somebody has destroyed their rice paddy crop. They've just gone through, they've torn out all the plants and just thrown trash in there and put a whole bunch of signs in there that says, go away, you know, nobody wants you here, the spies are not welcome, whatever. So it's like all that has been ruined. Just over. And Yuki doesn't say anything, I don't think. She just leaves the hut, goes straight to the rice paddy, and starts tearing the signs out of the ground. And Noge's mother, back at the thing, is begging the father, like, why don't you do anything? Don't you see how terrible, you know, we work so hard? And there's nothing going on, you know, that, like, Noge would not want us not to sit here and do nothing. And Yuki, you know, after tearing out some of the sign and separating the trash, starts replanting the rice plants by herself. And eventually, there's children that are like, right, like watching and yelling or chanting or whatever while Yuki is doing this, like replanting as hard as she can. And then all of a sudden, somebody else shows up and is like, you know, like this can't be, this shouldn't stand. This is disrespectful and terrible. And you people should be ashamed for doing something like this. And it's Noge's father. He's finally woken up out of his spell. And he's tearing one of those signs out of the ground himself.
I think that's the first time he speaks.
Yep, it is. And it's this triumphant moment, like, we're taking this back. Like, we're not going to be ashamed anymore. Like, you people should be ashamed now. And, you know, you get the general sense, the feeling that everything is going to work out for that, you know, family.
Mm-hmm.
We flash to a different scene where Yuki is back at home. She's tapping away at the piano, and her mother comes over. You know, I think she compliments her playing. She says, "It doesn't. Nope. These hands don't even look like the kind of hands that would be seen at a piano like this anymore."
Nope. But Ito shows up and is like, "Your mother told me to find you, and she wants to see you."
Oh, that's right.
And Ito, like, doesn't recognize her anymore. And she is kind of, she seems more kind of, like, mildly annoyed that he's there because she's working.
Right. She's not, I'm not going to stop just for this thing. I've got, like, work to do, buddy.
Yeah.
She's got a new appreciation for everything that's been going on. She sees the effects of, like, these people's lives and how they were torn apart by whatever was going on in Japan at the time, like, where Noge came from, you know, being born poor and having to work so hard. And so she, yeah, like, she's gained this thing at the end.
Yeah, and you can, yeah, like, the like, working hard on the rice field and then destroying it and just going, just doing it again, this, like, was what finally took her over the edge into becoming an activist.
Yeah, she became kind of the Rambo of Japan. No, I don't know. That's basically the end of the movie, right?
Yeah. And she, where was it? Oh, yeah, and she leaves her home again, and she gets on a truck, and there are these other, like, peasant farmers who, like, all recognize her, and then she rides away in the back of a pickup truck.
Yep. It's like the Dust Bowl. Everybody's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yay! She's one of the people.
Yeah. So, I like this movie a little more than I did when we started it.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, I feel like this one will definitely grow on me the more I think about it.
Yeah. I don't feel like this is a perfect movie. You know, when I called it a masterpiece, I mean that more in a sense that I think it's an important film.
Mm-hmm.
And it does some amazing things in a very early in
Kurosawa's
career, you know. And I feel like I said, it's an important film in probably in other filmmakers' lives.
Yeah, like to me, it feels like his first, like, uniquely Kurosawa work compared to like his first three movies. Yeah.
Well, I do feel like you can see shades of it in Sanshiro Sagata.
Yeah.
But it goes away when he's more dictated to what he has to do. Like, yeah. I also feel the men who tread on a tiger's tail,
mm-hmm.
you can see it there too. But his most, like I said, the movie that he says is the most personal for him feels the least like his style of movies.
Yeah.
I wonder what is with that?
Why he says most beautiful was his most personal?
It just feels mysterious to me, like in a way. Like, is he not...
Maybe because he met the love of his life.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything else. But apparently he always liked the movie for some reason.
Well... Either way, we're seeing him come into his own style.
Yeah. And the movie he did after this is his attempt at a rom-com that is... So I definitely would recommend watching this movie. It definitely is worth watching for just that Sukuhara. If you haven't seen her in anything, this is a great showcase of just why she's an icon of Japanese film.
Yeah, especially if you have seen a whole bunch of his other, you know, his more popular pieces, and you haven't seen this one, I think that you will enjoy this as a Kurosawa movie in general.
Yeah, it's...
It's just well done.
Yeah. And from here, he just kind of got better for most... Yeah, this, like, after this point, there's no real... awkward steps except for One Wonderful Sunday. But, like, this was, like, the first, to me, like, the first major Kurosawa movie, because he finally had the control to kind of do what he felt like he wanted to do.
Right.
And
I'm sure he was given directions on what the content had to be and stuff like that, but it does feel like he had more freedom.
Yeah, like, I like the epic scope of it, because it kind of goes from... Not epic scope, more like the movie is a personal journey, and you see, like, how the journey goes from this, like, upper class... like a rich lifestyle, urban, to, and you end up in like a small farming village, and it's this very noticeable, like, visual cue of the journey that has happened with us. Yep. with the set.
Yeah, that's it for me.
Yeah, and The next episode will be 1946. Six is Utamaru and His Five Women by Kenji Mizoguchi.
Mizoguchi?
Mizoguchi. Uto and His Five Women is on Filmstruck. It's not on any DVDs. I got that mixed up with some other Mizoguchi stuff that's on Criterion. And hopefully we'll have special guest Justin Harrison on. We just have to...
We haven't watched any Mizoguchi for the podcast, have we?
Not yet.
Yeah, that's interesting.
There's going to be a special on him in May, because May is his birthday month.
May is my birthday month.
Is it?
No, it's not.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure it was June. same as me, and Miss Hara also.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to get her this year.
A necromancer to revive her.
And then we can do an interview.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
And, let's see. You got stuff to plug?
Well, as always, if you want to hear more of me talking about movies, I do a science fiction and fantasy movie podcast called Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space with my two co-hosts, Sarah and Aaron. Each week, we talk about a different science fiction or fantasy movie. Most recently, we talked about I'm not sure if it's actually a Disney movie, but a Disney-esque slapstick comedy movie called Mr. Super Invisible, starring Dean Jones, wherein every PG-rated invisible joke you can come up with happens in the movie. Hmm. And there's an invisible monkey and an invisible dog. What else do you need to know?
It sounds fun.
Yep. And coming soon, episodes on Earth Girls Are Easy and Moon and what's the one you wanted to do?
Oh, Death Laid an Egg.
Death Laid an Egg, another Italian horror-esque movie.
Yeah, it's a fun, kooky little giallo with a very crazy soundtrack. What?
Sorry, what were you saying?
You can buy the soundtrack on Amazon. Worth getting if you like abstract weird music.
That's cool. Did you listen to our phenomenon stuff?
Yes.
Phenomena.
Yes. That movie is... I guess I'm immune to, like, gross bug stuff, because I didn't think the movie was gross.
The bug stuff is not that gross. I found the horror... when she's swimming around in that sewage.
Mm-hmm.
That part's gross.
Oh, yeah.
The bugs are fine.
Yeah, that's kind of Argento's last good movie. There's no reason to go beyond that, really.
Come on. I don't know. I can't remember the one I'm watching next. It's
Opera is 87?
No, it's the one with the doll's head on the cover.
Oh, Deep Red?
Yeah, Deep Red.
Deep Red is 76? Yeah, that's 75. Yeah, that was like right before Suspiria.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm in the safe zone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When you go past the mid-80s, it's a real shit show after that.
What about Dracula 3D?
Oh, where Dracula turns into a praying mantis?
As he does in the book, obviously.
Yeah. I like Argento, but man, he kind of fucked up his own legacy. Anyway, for me, Jailhouse 701, by the time this episode is up, I'll have the review of Battles Without Honor Humanity 3, Proxy War, but it's a really good series. It's all on Amazon. Joel, I think you would like the Battles with Honor and Without Honor and Humanity series.
All right.
Yeah. I recommend
it. I'm always looking for good stuff, so.
Yeah. Summer Knife Fight this month, I'm going to review something. I don't know what yet, but something. I think a TV movie. I can't remember what I'm going to do for this month. But yeah, or my old reviews on stuff like The Immortal, a TV movie from the late 60s where a guy is immortal and gets chased by a crazy billionaire.
I recommend Quincy's Quest.
Is that science fiction-y horror?
No, it's fantasy.
Yeah, I can't. I don't review that. I do science fiction and horror.
It's pretty horrific.
Yeah, so let's see. You can listen to the tag for the info stuff. And hashtag not gonna die forever. Hashtag chipmunk cheeks. Thug life, you know.
Watermelon.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Curacao podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podiant. Thank you for listening.
I'm not giving in, I'm finished. And walked away. Way. 1, 2, 3, that's the speed of the sea. ABC, that's the speed of the D. You could dream a little dreamer, you could live a little dream. I'd rather live it. But never get it. 1, 2, 3, that's the speed of the C. ABC, that's the speed of the D. You can dream a little dreamer, you can live a little dream. I'd rather live it. The dream is always chased, but never get it. Lucy was 37, an introverted somewhat. Right. Basement apartment in the same building she grew up in. Right. She traded in her blueberries for long locks, held up with a clip, traded in her yellow chalk for charcoal sticks. And she drew little Bobby who would come to sweep the floor. And she drew the mailman, delivered every day at 4. Lucy had very little contact with the folks outside her cubicle day, but found it suitable and she liked it that way. She had a man now. Similar, permanent. They would only see each other once or twice a week on purpose. They appreciated space, and Rico was an artist too, so they'd connect on Saturdays.